Yoga in all its forms has been a support for me in my life, through all the highs and lows. It's opened my mind and my heart in ways I never knew were possible. It has been a teacher, a taskmaster, and a friend. This podcast is an offering. I wish to share the teachings of yoga with you as a tool to help navigate life. Namaste, and welcome. Welcome. I'm so happy you're here. So I wanted to discuss something that if you go back into past episodes, probably, I think it's probably the third or fourth episode, I started to talk about the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali. And they've come up a few times in our episodes because it is the philosophy of yoga. It's also, in my opinion, in my experience, it's a how-to manual for how to be a human and how to survive this human condition, these behaviors and habits and patterns that sometimes we find ourselves empowered by and sometimes we feel ourselves shackled by. So the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, I wanted to give you another overview of it. And the thing that's so amazing about the sutras is they're never a one and done. So when you read the sutras, I started reading them and was introduced to them formally 20 years ago. But they were something I was aware of prior to that, but very much on the surface. I didn't get exposed to the Yoga Sutras 20 years ago, take a course in my teacher training, read up on them, write some essays, and then I'm finished. As I change as a human being, and as life happens to me, and as I have different life experiences, and as I age, I experience the sutras from different perspectives every time I go back in, every time I explore whether one or two chapters or one or two of the sutras, I am always coming to it with a fresh new perspective because, again, life changes us. So this is one of those things. This is an ancient text where you're not just going to look at it once and master it. It's so cool because every time you reacquaint yourself or have a reunion with the sutras, you reunite yourself with these teachings, new ideas are revealed, new layers of yourself are exposed. So what I'm in the process of now is I'm doing a group of teachings, four classes, one course on the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali. So I thought what I would do with a few episodes that are going to run alongside the time frame of that course is I'd give an overview each week. So the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali are an ancient text. They are thousands of years old. They are broken down into four chapters, or what's known as padas, P-A-D-A, and there's 196 aphorisms in these four chapters. The context of this is how to put it. You know, these were oral transmissions done thousands of years ago in India. They have a Hindu base to them, but they are very much aligned with Buddhist teachings and things of that nature. They were originally an oral transmission, but then at one point they were transcribed onto leaves. And they would stack the leaves and pile up the leaves and add to the leaves as these new aphorisms or ideas, I guess, came to them. And one of the reasons they did it that way is because they could rearrange the leaves as they experienced the teachings and discovered the teachings, right? And they would, you know, say, oh, I don't know, you know, maybe I got here and then I experienced the obstacles, or, you know, maybe the afflictions, I found another affliction, the kleshas, you know, there's not just da 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 da, there's this other one. So they could move the leaves around. And then one day still thousands of years ago, it was put into more of a set order. And that set order is what we work on now. So the sutras are, again, they're very much a teaching of the machinations of the mind, how the mind works. And what's interesting about the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, one of the things that is interesting is the way the book is set up. So as I said, there's four chapters, 196 aphorisms. And the first chapter is called Samadhi Pada. And Samadhi can be translated, it's a Sanskrit word that can be translated as calm abiding. It can be translated as meditative concentration. Very often people will define Samadhi as, well, they'll say complete absorption. And I too have said that in the past, but my teacher, Bob Thurman, has been doing a play on the word absorption, saying, you know, we're not all paper towels, you know, we're not all bounty sheets absorbing things. So I love that because it made me realize, yeah, for Samadhi to mean complete absorption would actually, if you break down the word, would mean that we are allowing ourselves to be absorbed by things. And in actuality, that's not what's happening. So we could actually change that term into Samadhi means meditative concentration in which the experiencer becomes completely absorbed in the thing. So you're not absorbing anything, you are absorbed in something. And so Samadhi is that experience. And we have all had that experience from time to time. One of the examples given frequently is, you know, if you are working on a project, if you are writing or painting or anything that you're doing, it could be building a chair, whatever you're doing, you could be watching a show, and you are completely absorbed on the thing, and you don't realize somebody just walked into the room, you don't hear the doorbell, you've kind of shut everything out. So you are absorbed in the thing that you are focusing or the experience that you're having. So Samadhi is that. It's when we enter into this state of calm abiding and we're able to be wholly, fully with and aware of whatever it is that's happening in the moment. So he starts the first chapter of this four-chaptered book with Samadhi Pada. And so Pada means chapter. It's one of the words. It also means foot. It means a few things. But in this context, it means chapter. And so what he does in the first chapter is he says, here's the goal. Here's what's possible. And as you read through the aphorisms of the first chapter, you are turned on to and keyed into this real thing that you can achieve a meditative concentration. You can achieve a calm abiding. And in the second chapter, he's going to show you how. So the second chapter is Sadhana Pada. And sadhana means practice. Sadhana means practice or how to go about doing something. Steps, disciplines. So interestingly enough, you'll often find, and I used to do this years and years ago, is teachers will present the second chapter first. I don't do that anymore because I kind of like, I really understand now the choice behind putting the Samadhi Pada chapter first. In other words, giving you the goal, showing you what's possible. And it's not just possible for some, it's possible for all. And so it's kind of like a little sales pitch, like you too can have calm abiding, chapter one, like, you know, and then you're like, okay, like I want this thing. This thing sounds really cool. You mean the mind does this and the mind does that? Okay, and then the second chapter, here's how, you know, here's the DIY kit, you know, here's the you know, here are the tools. Okay. And then the third chapter is the Vibhuti chapter, V-I-B-H-U-T-I. And that's when we start getting into extraordinary powers, like supernatural abilities, you know, like, I don't know, just whatever you can imagine is supernatural. And very often teachers don't go too far into the third and fourth chapters because they can tend to be a little esoteric. And I don't avoid them for any other reason. And I don't fully avoid them because the fourth chapter is Gvayapada, and that's about supreme liberation. I don't avoid 3 and 4, especially when I'm sharing them as teachings, but there's so much in 1 and 2, Samadhipada and Sadhanapada, that it's many lifetimes work to implement the tools from that second chapter. So what he's really sharing with us, Patanjali, in the first chapter is he's saying, by doing these single-pointed practices that he's going to show us in the second chapter, you begin to uncover and reveal the mind's tendencies, the mind's turnings, the anxiety that you may have, and all the rest. And then, and we've talked about this in earlier episodes, at one point he then shows us the 8-limbed path that will set us free from the anxiety. But first you've got to see the anxiety, or first you've got to see the grief, or first you have to see the discontent before you can address it. And so he shows you how the mind works so that you can become aware of when the trappings of the mind are letting themselves be known. You know, it's interesting. I was reading recently, because it keeps coming up in different areas. People mention it, and I've read about it, heard it on podcasts, but this IFS, which is a form of therapy that's been around by quite some time. I think it was created by a gentleman, Dr. Schwartz, I think is his name. And IFS is internal family systems. And one of the notions or ideas in this internal family systems is that we are all comprised of parts. And the parts that we have, they give them different titles, you know, the protector and all these things. And it shows us that, it tries to teach us that you are not, I don't know how to say this, but you're not just an I, is one of the ways they put it, meaning the letter I. You're comprised of many parts, and once you start to recognize all your different parts and how they behave, then you can build a relationship with those parts and allow and accept those parts because they're part of you and they have a job. So sometimes our parts that are our protectors will step in and make choices and do things that later on, when we don't feel activated or threatened by something, we might look at as self-sabotage. Like, why did I do that thing? Why did I choose that thing? Well, because a part of you thought that's what you needed to be safe in that moment. What I find interesting about this, and something I read about this Dr. Schwartz, who came to this awareness many years ago in his practice, was that's what we're doing when we study the Yoga Sutras. That's what we're doing when we embark on a yoga practice. It's a study of the self in all of its parts. And you do have to sit down long enough to be able to be introduced to all your parts. And one of the things that I've shared in the past is Vipassana meditation. I think it's in a recent episode that I shared Vipassana meditation. Might have even been the last one. I don't know what's what. The podcast just kind of comes out of me and then I click publish. But Vipassana meditation is one of the ways that we learn about our parts. by sitting with an event in our life where we were wrongfully accused of something and feeling the sensations in our body that come up around that event when somebody, like I said, wrongfully accused us. And learning about your parts is pretty similar. Also, just it's that very important choice to be in touch with the sensations as they arise in your body when you're activated by an event in your life. Because as I've said before, and in relationship to Vipassana meditation, everything that's ever happened to you is stored in you. It's not anywhere else. It's stored in you. So this idea of this, one of the components to IFS therapy, internal family systems therapy, is to get in touch with the different parts of you and to accept them, converse with them, relate to them, and let them know that there's actually an adult in the room and it's you. Because a lot of these parts are formed in our young self and they work. That's a lot of what we're learning now about trauma as well. Back in the day, you know, talk therapy and therapists were going to go, oh, you've had trauma. Okay, we hear it, we see it, we know it. Let's put it over there. And how can we give you some positive affirmations? Or, you know, can you find a hobby that's going to make you happy? Hey, all good things. But that trauma is sitting in a box and it's making choices for you. And it's not, it doesn't care about the collateral damage. The truth now that neuroscientists are discovering is that you need to actually face the trauma and all the parts that go with it. Because for those that have experienced crises and trauma, in the moments of trauma, you discovered, most likely unaware, a coping tool. And that coping tool worked. It had a positive purpose, but it doesn't work anymore or always. And so with care and with support, it is said to be most beneficial to actually walk through your trauma instead of going the other way. This is all the Yoga Sutras. So neuroscientists, therapists, self-help people, spiritual life coaches, they're all regurgitating in a way, and thank God they are, it's all great, ancient texts. But when you embark on the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, which is one of my favorite texts and greatest supports, along with the Bhagavad Gita, I love that too, and some Buddhist texts. When you start diving into these things, you really do get some very powerful tools that can take you through almost anything, almost anything. So you want to recognize that our mind is always working. You know, if someone says to you, oh, what do you do? And I say, oh, I'm a yoga teacher, I'm a meditation teacher. And they go, oh, meditation, I can't meditate. I try to sit and meditate and my mind just won't stop. And I say to them, that's awesome. You're aware of that? You see that your mind is constantly going? That's meditation. Stay with that. Keep visiting that. Keep working with that. Because in the Yoga Sutras, we learn that the mind has what's called vrittis. It has fluctuations. That's the design of the mind. Vrittis is translated as fluctuations and also turnings, twistings, movement, and that's all cool. But what we do when we embark on the yoga path and when we embark on a meditation practice and any introspective self-help work is we want to build a relationship with the twistings. We want to build a relationship with the fluctuations, because only in building a relationship with these things can we cultivate discernment. And why do we need to cultivate discernment? Because I need to know what fluctuations I need to keep and what fluctuations I need to not give so much attention to. And that's what yoga and meditation teach us. And that's what the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali walk us through in these four chapters. So in the first chapter, Samadhipada, they're saying to you, hey, this is how your mind works. It's not just you. This is how all the minds work. This is how all the human brains have worked for thousands of years. And then in chapter two, Sadhanapada, you get the how-to. And if this work were easy, I don't know, I can't imagine. I guess I like to say that, you know, the easy attainment of things tend to be less in value or less, you know, they're not the gems that things that are harder to attain are. So I don't want this work to be easy because it's not for the lighthearted. It really requires a discipline. And I think that's another reason that the first chapter was designed the way it was, to be the how, to not be the how-to, because it shows you what's possible. But the more you go into being shown what's possible, when you realize how much is possible, it's like, whoa, you know? And so, okay, are you in this? Like, are you all in this? Like, are you all in? Let's go. You know, and here's what you got to do. And here's how you do it. And one of the sutras, and I'm not reading it verbatim, I'm just shooting off the top of my head, is, you know, Patanjali really enforces consistent practice. You can't be flipping and flopping. You can't be going, you know, every third Wednesday, I'm going to address my mind. I'm going to meditate. And I'm going to read a sutra. You can't. It requires discipline, because the mind is a powerful thing. And what we're looking to do is we're looking to harness it so that we can put that power to our purpose, to really good use. You know, your stuff comes up when you practice yoga and when you go into meditation and you do all of this kind of work, and it's varying ways in which we can approach this kind of work. But your stuff is going to come up. That's what yoga does. It brings up your stuff like a bad lunch. And some can handle it and some can't. But I got to tell you, that stuff that it's bringing up, it's toxic. It's poisonous. And I would much rather bring it up and look at it than have it stuck inside of me and doing its job on the insides, making me choose, you know, things, behaviors, attitudes that are not in line with my truth and cause me suffering. So it's in you. The mind is a beautiful thing. The Yoga Sutras of Patanjali are a blueprint or a map for the mind. Yoga is about connection, and we must engage in connection with the self before we can have union or yoga or any kind of namaste with the rest of the world or just our partners or our family. So I want to share with you in closing, it's a little parable called The Wise Woman's Stone. And I thought it was sweet. And it begins the book called The Secret Power of Yoga by Nishala Joy Devi, A Woman's Guide to the Heart and Spirit of the Yoga Sutras. It's one of the Yoga Sutra books that I recommend. I recommend many. A wise woman who was traveling in the mountains found a precious stone in a stream. She reverently placed the gem in her bag. The next day, she met another traveler who was hungry. The wise woman opened her bag to share her food. The hungry traveler saw the precious stone in the wise woman's bag, admired it, and asked the wise woman to give it to him. The wise woman did so without hesitation. The traveler left, rejoicing in his good fortune. He knew the jewel was worth enough to give him security for the rest of his life. But a few days later, he came back, searching for the wise woman. When he found her, he returned the stone and said, "I have been thinking. I know how valuable the stone is, but I would like to exchange it in the hope that you can give me something much more precious. If you can, teach me the secrets about the power you have within you, the power that enabled you to, without hesitation, give me this precious stone. Ah, I do love that, the wise woman's stone. And the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, well, they are the tools to help us cultivate that calm abiding that already exists within. Remember, you're not buying anything new out on the shelf. It's bringing you back home to the truth of who you are. So we'll continue these in the next few episodes so that you can kind of be running alongside of the course that I'm offering. And if you are in the course and listening to this, well, I hope this is a little review for you each week. Hands together at the Heart Center. May all beings be happy and peaceful. May all beings be healthy and strong. May all beings be safe and protected. May all beings live with ease. Namaste.